Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Fourth Age. And I, of course, am Virginia, here as always. And with us this week, we have Spencer.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here. And also joining us is Carrie.
Hello, everybody.
Well, this week we have a number of voicemails to discuss. And we, as we've always said many times, we always appreciate hearing from listeners. So that's what we're going to be talking about for this episode.
Yes, today we're going to be doing listener feedback, and it's always great to hear from people who are as big a fans of Wheel of Time as we are, and who, for some reason, enjoy hearing us ranting about it. Before we get into our first one, though...
Spoiler warning.
We are going to be discussing all 13 books in the main Wheel of Time series, plus the prequel, and probably the Big White Book, and anything else that comes to hand. Including other series. So this is your warning for spoilers about The Wheel of Time. We're going to be talking about all the books. If we go into spoilers about other series and such, we'll warn you about those first because we don't like to be too mean. Tonight, I'm kind of going to be the keeper of the sound bites, mostly because I was a bit behind and didn't get the list of what we have out to everyone so that they can see it. Our first voicemail is from David, and he's talking about Forced Turnings.
Hey, Dragon Mount crew. This is David Robinson. I live up in Alaska. Actually, been a little while since I've done a reread. I have the new book, and I just unfortunately haven't gotten to get into reading it yet. Actually, I was calling to leave a voicemail on with a comment for episode 56 of the podcast. You guys have started talking about users of the One Power and how they might shake out after the last battle and brought up the Forsaken and the potential to turn the Forsaken in the same way that the Dark One, Dreadlords, 13 Dreadlords and 13 Mirdral can turn someone who walks in the light. And I just wanted to bring up a point that it's kind of not the way of the light to turn someone. It doesn't seem to really work that way. In a lot the same way that the Creator really doesn't take much of an active hand within the happenings of the world. He has his agents, he's got the heroes bound to the Horn of Valir and the Dragon Reborn, but in the way that the Dark One will physically reach in and personally try to manipulate events to serve his own needs, the Creator seems to not do that. And I think it goes along the same lines for turning someone to light. It must be a conscious choice, and really, if you think about it, a lot of effort put in to defeat eons of bad habits for one of the Forsaken to actually turn back to the light. Even Asmodian was really motivated less by really wanting to help, being desirous of helping Rand, than the fact that he had already done so much damage that he didn't have anywhere to go. If any of the Forsaken found him, they would have killed him on the spot, as they did. So, just wanted to throw my two cents in there. I don't think that the Aes Sedai will find any way to forcibly turn any channelers to the light, just because it seems to be kind of contrary to the mode in which the light works, rather than the dark, which takes every opportunity to force someone to do what they want. So, just my two cents. Thanks, guys. Love the podcast. Bye.
Well, thank you, David, for that. And for those of you who are wondering, episode 56 is the geopolitical ramifications of the last battle for the channelers. Yes, it's a long title, which is probably why he said episode 56. And if you want to go back and listen to that and you don't have it in your iTunes already, then you can go to dragonmount.com/podcast/episodes.php.
He brings up a good point, and I think I probably have to agree with that to a certain extent. It probably is contrary to the way things have been operating so far, but that doesn't mean it couldn't happen.
Yeah, I agree pretty much with what he was saying. Instead of turning somebody, from the dark side to the light side, I think maybe it might be more plausible to say, because I understand what he's saying about that, that the creator doesn't need to take an active hand in that. And, but maybe it might be possible to have those that were, that already walked in the light and then they got turned, like what's going on right now at the Black Tower. Maybe there's a way to lift that or turn those people back to the light. So you're not forcibly, it's not like you're actually forcibly turning them to the light. You're just bringing them back to what they were originally. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And I have to kind of agree with that. You know, I don't think we know fully what the mechanics of the forced turning is. You know, we talked about it a little bit on this show, how it, I think it was Jennifer Liang from Dragon Mount who said that it magnifies the worst qualities of a person until the point where they basically are just this evil shell of a human being, this nasty thing. But I think the two closest things we have to compare it to, the first is compulsion, obviously. And the second, it, to my mind, is the effects that the taint had on male channelers. What we saw that looked like in the early middle of Towers of Midnight, where Nynaeve was messing around inside one of the Ashaman's heads. It does seem to me like if the mechanics for a turning are similar enough to those of compulsion and the effects of the taint, that Nynaeve will have some way to kind of peel it off, to remove it, like she did both the compulsions in the Gathering Storm and the crazy in Towers of Midnight.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, too, that definitely, obviously, if it's to be done, it's going to be by Nynaeve. And I thought of that when I was reading that part that happened back in Towers of Midnight, because I don't know. I think about that. I've always thought about that. You know, it's one of those things with the turning, even though we hadn't seen it before this book. And I always kind of wondered about it. And you know it's coming. So, but I think it would be interesting to see if that happens or, you know, how it happens. Because you'd have to wonder how she'd get somebody that's been turned to the shadow. Like what the circumstances would be around her trying to heal them back to normal. So I was thinking maybe it would happen to somebody that she's close to and that she would be trying to find a way to save them, because that would give her the intention to go and do that. Because it's not like she's going to walk up to an Ashaman, that you don't know much about and try and turn them back.
Well, no, she's more likely to focus on the Aes Sedai. Simply being an agent of the tower and the fact that, you know, women should never be chained like this anyway.
Which kind of makes me wonder if it is going to happen to somebody that she knows or that she's closer to.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll all admit that we are just assuming that what's going on at the Black Tower is people being turned against their will. But I think it's a safe assumption, seeing as this gun has been hanging on the mantle for a long time now, and we have yet to see it loaded, let alone fired.
I always have that problem where I think that something seems obvious, but it's not. It doesn't mean that it's right, correct. It seems kind of obvious to me that's what's going on. And we knew that it was going to come and play a part at some point with the series. So we only have one more book left, now or never.
It is very interesting to my mind, though, that the first time this is introduced to us is in the third book with Egwene's test for accepted. And we're just now barely in the 13th book of the series. We're barely seeing anything that might possibly bear the mark of a forced turning. I would be very surprised if there wasn't someone else that we've met along the way who was turned against their will and we just didn't recognize it.
We just didn't know. Yeah.
Well, it kind of bothers me that they are obviously different after that. The ones in the Black Tower are obviously different. You know, they have the expression, they have the changed personalities and so forth.
Yeah.
That kind of bothers me because it seems to me that if it was going to be really successful, it would be less noticeable.
I was wondering if they have any control over that. If they were trying to, like at the Black Tower, the majority of them they're around are obviously also turned. And I don't think they're worried about what other people are thinking so much, you know? But I wonder if that's in their control to kind of pretend like if some, so if somebody was, like around Rand or Egwene or one, you know, one of the characters, if there's a way that they can still try and be more natural like their old self, or do they have no control over that and they're just different? They look different and, you know, you could tell it, tell in their eyes that their eyes are different. So just kind of, I was thinking of that because I can't remember. I was watching something on TV and I was just, that just triggered it. I was thinking about that and I was just kind of thinking, I wonder if they could take it. Or is it like they just don't care anymore and they wouldn't even try? They're just, that's it. That's the way they are.
It's going
to be robotic.
Yeah.
And people would be a lot less useful if there was, you know, such an obvious method of telling.
Yeah.
Well, and I also have to wonder if part of it might not be the skill of the person leading the Circle of 13 that's channeling through the 13, or if it is a Circle of 13, they might just be channeling individually. And if it's not, somewhat at least, a question of the skill of those channelers. Because we've heard time and again the Forsaken, who are the last remaining, besides, you know, Luz Theron, which is kind of a different thing altogether, but they're the last surviving Denzians of the Age of Legends. We've heard them oftentimes refer to the Aes Sedai and to the channelers in general of this age as children. And to my mind, you know, when I compare the two, the big difference between the channelers then and the channelers now, besides just the general decrease in the average amount of the average strength and the power, the biggest difference is the finesse with which they can channel. I mean, even the Aes Sedai, even the female channelers of this age, I say this age, even though it's not, but you all know what I'm talking about, that they seem to favor kind of more of a brute force attack or a brute force method of channeling as opposed to kind of the finer weeds. I mean, think of the healing that they did. It was crude, rudimentary, battle side healing or battle front healing. And it wasn't until Nynaeve came along and started weaving these intricate webs that they got, you know, some semblance of true healing back. And so I have to wonder if it's not a little bit about the people channeling in the circle that's doing the turning, if their lack of finesse or use of too much kind of blunt strength is causing the massive change in attitude along with the turning.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it really does.
I'm glad, because I got myself lost halfway through.
But getting back to what David was saying as far as somebody being turned back to the light, I don't think it would necessarily be a case of somebody being forced, as maybe that there was a willingness there, you know, like Intar to do that. But, you know, I don't know that the light side would necessarily do that forcefully. But I think it could be done maybe, you know, if there was a desire for that on the part of the person that had been turned, might make a big difference.
Yeah, you know, it like he points out, it is kind of against everything that the light stands for to force someone to be good. But
yeah,
I do have to wonder, you know, we've kind of joked about, you know, to force someone to forcibly turn them back to the light, you would have to channel through Ogier or something. But I do have to wonder, maybe, if there isn't some truth to that, if it's not, though, channeling through them, but something more along the lines of a Circle of Ogier singing doesn't necessarily force them to turn, but it does open the door that allows them to shrug off whatever effects the turning had on them.
Well, yeah, and maybe there's sort of an exemption because obviously the people that were turned by force didn't want to be turned, so maybe there's, you know, some provision in place for them to, you know, to be covered if they wanted to be.
We know that Luke and Isam have, some for some strange, unknown reason, decided to embrace the dark side.
Yeah, really.
This voicemail is from John, and he is talking about Tarmon Gaidon.
Hi, my name is John Kroniak, and I was just calling to respond to the Tarmon Gaidon episode that you had back in May. I think one part that you guys left out, I didn't hear, was the Horn of Valir being linked to Ilion. And in the first three books, you know, Moraine was pretty much dead set on getting Rand to Ilion with the horn. So my thoughts are that Tarmogoyen is not going to be fought at Arwen's death. It's going to be more or less fought in or around Ilion, or that will be the last part of the battle. I think that you guys are kind of really reducing the amount of Trollocs and Fades that are around in the Blight. The Blight is huge, and probably there's millions of Trollocs up there in the Blight. So if they can come out in a massive horde overwhelming the Borderlands, Land's army, and Roland, sorry, I can't pronounce the last name of Troll Day. And then if you look at the books, the army, they're kind of in fallback points right now where they're almost perfectly positioned for a Supreme Commander, a Matt, to take a look at the forces and let the forces fall back to the tower, to Tamlin, to Turing, to Tyr, to Ilion, and the same with the Shanshan forces, where they can fall back on the way from Ered Domin to Chico to Ibadar, and then to Ilion as well. And that gives the Seafolk ships, which are mostly staged in Ilion, a great fast escape route for all the forces of light in case something goes horribly wrong. And Ilion is there where Matt needs the salvation of the horn. It shows up in his hands one way or the other, and he blows the horn. And at the same time, Rand can be fighting his last battle at Shao Ghul and, you know, have the massive projector screen in the sky of his battle with the dark, and however that plays out. But just my thoughts on your Tarmogoyen episode. Thank you.
And thank you, John, for that. The Tarmogoyen episode, or Geadon, however you want to pronounce it, was episode 71. And again, you can find that at the aforementioned link. You know, that's very interesting that he brought up that Ilion is kind of the final fallback point for the whole world, basically. When I think of the last battle, I have this tendency in my mind for myself to kind of think of the dramatic Lord of the Rings type ending where they ride to the gates of Mordor or Sheol Gul, pound on them and say, come fight us. I know I fail to realize most of the time that the last battle, really by the beginning of Towers of Midnight, had already started. The fight for Meridon that Rodel Etralda did, that was really the opening gambits of the last battle. Especially by the end of the epilogue, you know, we have Lon charging into Tarwin's Gap, we have Camelin in flames. We don't know about anywhere else in the world, but I bet that there is multi-front attack going on right now, especially where most of the leaders of the world are with Rand and Egwene somewhere in the middle of the Carlin Plains. Or Carlin? Carlin? I don't know. Somewhere north of it.
Yeah, the Carolin Grass or something like that. But
yeah, whatever it's called, that big empty spot. Yeah, the big empty spot in the middle of the world. Anyway, we know that the last battle is starting, and it's going to be much more of a war than a single battle. We know that it's going to take up an entire book, and this is a Wheel of Time book. This has to be epic and long, and so there has to be this. We have to keep in mind that this has to be long enough that there can be give and take and give and take and armies falling back and then back some more and then maybe getting a little bit of ground but then having to go back even more. So I think the idea that Ilion is going to be the final staging point is really probably something that we need to watch out for.
Yeah, I think there was also some report from the Blue Eyes and Ears that several other of the Borderlands were being besieged. Kandor and Arathel, I believe, were mentioned. Egwene got a report about it. And she mentioned it in the hall.
I will say that I'm not as worried about the Trollocs and the Maedril as I might have been if we hadn't seen epic, amazing fire from the sky Rand at the end of the Battle of Meridon. I am, however, worried about the Dreadlords and the amount of Dreadlords that they have, because you have enough Dreadlords and even the massive, amazing amount of power that Rand has won't be able to destroy all of the Trollocs. If he's busy fighting Dreadlords, then he won't be able to kill Trollocs as he needs to.
Or the Dark One.
Yeah, that's another big worry I have, is that Rand is going to ignore the rest of the battles and just head straight for the Dark One, leaving the rest of the world to fend for themselves.
So he seems to be trying to arrange it so that they're pretty well set up, that how much can he do in the short time he's got left, you know?
Right. He's got to make sure he has to do what needs to be done. Yeah, and I am the same, where I just kind of envisioned it, like, to go right there to show Ghoul and that's it. Like, you know, it is true. It's going to be something that's probably going to be fought all over Randland. So
I think it's really cool now, because now we've really seen a way for Perrin in particular to become a major player in the actual fighting, rather than just leading endless lines of wolves to the last battle. Now he's got Malaliner, and, you know, he's become pretty self-actualized and understanding more of what his role is. He's embraced the fact that he needs to be what he is. Originally, Maureen thought that Rand was going to be the one to blow the horn. That didn't work out the way she thought. You think that that's what Nat was referring to when he said, sent the message, tell the Amelin, whichever one it is, that they have something of mine and I'm coming for it? You think that's the horn?
Oh, yeah. Or that's what I thought.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, definitely. I'm just not sure about Ilion, because I don't know how Maureen would know that. I thought they were just heading there. I didn't think it had anything to do with that, but could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't really think that we have anything to do with Ilion particularly, other than everything else will.
And we do need to see some action at Sheogul. We just have to, because we've heard so much about it, and, you know, from the Forsaken's point of view and different things like that. But we need to, I don't know, I just feel like Rand needs to go there, you know?
Yeah, well, Rand needs to go there, but in the same vein, I don't want it to be like The Lord of the Rings, where you have, you know, this epic battle going on around the world, and you have these two people climbing a mountain. It could be interesting. I don't want to see it. I want to see substantial attack force, you know, assaulting Sheol Ghul while Rand sneaks into the boar.
Oh, okay.
But that's just what I want to see. That's not necessarily what'll happen.
I always see different things. Do you see it like a movie? Like, or it's just going to be awesome?
I said this before. I think he's going to take a lot of it into Salamandria just so that it won't break the world again. He's so paranoid about doing that.
It'll be interesting to know. He's going to have to break the seals first, so that'll have to be done. And then I don't even know what to expect after that, because that's just releasing the Dark One from his prison.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but the boar has gotten even smaller than it was in the Age of Legends. And in the Age of Legends, although the Dark One could touch the world, the armies of the Light were still fairly effective in their fight against the armies of the Dark One. I think the biggest trick for Rand is going to the seals, but also the Dark One himself, out of the way so that the pattern can reseal the boar. All right, well, thank you, John, and we could go on, but we better stop our speculation, otherwise this will turn into another Tarmogoyf Guide on episode, and we don't want to do that. So we're going to move on to our third and our final one for tonight, which is Charlie, who's talking about Moraine, and his, I think, is the only of these three that we got after Towers of Midnight came out, so...
Hi there, this is Charlie calling from Portland, Oregon, and I'm calling because I was just listening to the podcast that you did that was specifically all about Moraine, episode 72, and one of the things that you were just discussing in there was now that Moraine is going to be released, and at this point Towers of Midnight is out and she has been saved, how she would respond to Swan and seeing Swan and the power difference and Swan's difference in her appearance. And one of the things that I was curious about is it seems pretty clear to me that in some way the ageless face of the Aes Sedai is tied to their being sworn on the Oath Rod, and that Swan's change in her face was because she was released from her oaths when she was stilled. And I was thinking about the re-encounter between Swan and Moraine, and you were saying that Moraine probably wouldn't recognize her. But given the fact that Swan and Moraine were really close friends in the White Tower, and then very shortly after they became Aes Sedai, they both went their separate ways, it seems to me that when Moraine left, Swan would not have started to take on the ageless look, in which case Moraine would see the Swan that she remembered from all of her girlhood days, not the Swan that is an Aes Sedai, because they didn't really enact or encounter one another much after that. So I just wanted to bring up that possibility and see what your thoughts were on it. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Charlie. it does point out in the books that Suan, after she is stilled, does not look the same as she did before she took the oaths. She looks completely different. When she visits and goes before the hall there, they don't recognize her until she starts spouting off knowledge that only she should have. She doesn't look the way that she did even before she got the oaths, and I don't think that is ever fully explained.
She looks younger, but she doesn't look like how she looked when she was that age that she looks now.
Yeah.
She looks different.
Yeah, and especially Sheriam and Carolina.
Carlinia.
Yeah, Carlinia, who grew up and were novices and accepted with them, with Suan and Liane and Moraine. The fact that they didn't recognize them, really, that's another one of the reunions, the Moraine's back reunions that I can't wait to see, is the Moraine sees Suan and Suan sees Moraine, and how much they have both, you know, decreased in the power from what they were. Which I think is really interesting that, you know, the two strongest channelers since whenever, how they've become kind of the least powerful. They're even beneath what's her name that got killed in the Gathering Storm, Daigin, who was the youngest.
Daigin was one of the weakest, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if Suan is and Liane are weaker than Daigin. I think Moraine, in public at least, she won't show her surprise as much because she's Moraine. But definitely when she and Suan get together, there will be some interesting interaction.
I still think that Moraine's going to recognize her, though. Maybe not right away, but, I mean, Gareth Brain, he kind of... Remember, he thought there was something familiar about her, he couldn't place it, and he didn't even really know her, Suan.
Yeah.
And it's her eyes, they say. So... Moraine and her were so close, so even though she looks different, I don't know, I think that she's still going to recognize something in her.
And I think that, going back to the topic, I think that Moraine will probably take it all in stride. There's so much else going on, you know, that everything's breaking down in the world. I mean, she's got a lot of catching up to do. I think that Suan and Liana is going to be just... one more thing that she'll have to take in stride. I mean, let's face it, she's been out of touch for how many books now? But anyway, it's been definitely 6 months to a year she's been gone.
Right.
I mean, she did get all the way out of the way. Suan was there for several months. I mean, the whole timeline is like 2 years, right? The better part of the year, she's been kind of out of it. I'm quite sure that the Finns were not allowing her to have, you know, news and world report
no.
or,
no.
you know, Carrie Ann Daly or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So she has no idea. She's going to have a lot of catching up to do before she can really even, almost really even be useful. How is it that the Finn were able to drain her power and cannot be healed?
Yeah.
I think that's a whole topic in itself right there. How do they have the ability to drain her power? We've never seen that happen in any other respect. We've never seen that happen, either stilled or not.
When you live in a world where you have to walk back and forth to get anywhere, where you have to pace up and down a hall to get anywhere, you end up being just a little kooky.
Well, we don't know that they have to go back and forth. They just make other people have to run back and forth. They may know their universe is folded in ways they understand. It may be a straight line to them. They may be able to walk it in a straight line where only the people that are trying to make it around in there have to deal with the reversals and everything. I don't know.
Yeah, they have a special organ that's simply for space-time travel so that you can step through these weird
We have Murdral who are slightly out of phase with reality or something like that so that their cloaks don't move in the wind and they can zip back and forth between shadows and stuff like that. So there is precedent for that sort of thing. I mean, they may just be able... I mean, to them, it may be a straight line because they're able to see parts of the dimensions that our guys can't. I don't know.
And there's the fact that when you go through the doorways, there's no mention of them turning around and going back the way they came and suddenly they're in a different spot. So I have to assume that there's some way that if you're with them, they can lead you from one place to another without having to make you turn around and go back.
Oh, they do. You know, they have the guide to take them straight there. You know, they don't go back and forth when they've got a guide. We've seen that with Matt twice.
I kind of see, because there is so much, like you were saying before, I think Virginia was saying, that Moraine's been gone for so long. I mean, it's not just the course of a normal year, right? So there's so much that's happened. And I kind of see it like we're going to see a reunion, and then all of a sudden they're going to kind of take off and fade out of the story while they're going and someone's catching up with her and telling her stuff. I don't know. I know Matt's been telling her stuff and Tom and stuff, but when she sees Maureen, I think they're going to have to set some time aside to sit down. But maybe we might not see that.
Yeah, well, what they'll do is they'll just do a Vulcan mind meld and just they'll transfer the memories, and then they won't have to worry about, right, you know, the time that it takes. Well, you know, with Elaine, you know, studying all these different weeds and making things up to, you know, connect people into circles like non-channelers and, you know, bonding non-channelers to channelers and all this, you know, I'm sure that she could find some variation on a weave that is basically the Vulcan mind meld.
I don't know what they're going to come up with. I was going to say girls, but they're not really girls anymore. What they're going to, you know, what they're going to come up with next, but...
Yeah, we still call them our Wonder Girls, though, even though most of them are women. One of them's about to have children.
I know. Because that's just how you think of them.
Yeah. Well, even though Nynaeve's only, like, what, 3 to 5 years older than them, I still call her a girl, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think of her as the authority status that she had. You know, I have a tendency to think of her as a... more adult than the others that left with Moraine out of the Two Rivers. Still, she's one of the Wonder Girls.
Yeah.
And yet, in some ways, she was one of the most childish.
Oh, dear, yes.
Don't tell her that. Don't let her hear
that. But then who wasn't? I mean, you think of what Moraine did to Lan and or Lan, and that wasn't childish? You know, dropping a pond on him, torturing him night by after night with different insects so that he doesn't get any sleep. Yeah. And then expecting him to wake up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and save you the next day. Whatever.
That was pretty petty, I must say.
Yeah. It's so un-Maureen. That's why that was great. Too bad we'll have any other prequels probably, but... we don't know for sure, but...
Yeah.
It was really interesting to see Maureen as she was then.
Yeah.
And Swan. Well, Swan didn't really change that much. Maureen's the one that battled with maturity. Maureen.
Yeah, that's true.
Everyone, I think every Wheel of Time fan is unanimous in their request that we see the prequels. I think we all want to see, you know, more of Tam. You know, how he came to have the Heron Mark blade, you know, see that story, how he came to be an Ilian in the first place, how he met Carrie. You know, more of the Aiel War would be incredibly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Great to see. Yeah. And then, of course, the story of how Moraine just happens to get there the day that the Trollocs attack. Yeah, that would be great.
I know, what a coincidence.
I know.
There are no coincidences in the Wheel of Time.
Yeah, especially not with Reed Tavirin running around.
No.
But on the topic of Moraine, what did you guys think of scene between her and Tom that Matt obviously was, I mean, I think we all were, but Matt obviously wasn't expecting. What did you guys think of that?
Well, I was totally expecting it. I mean, that's very, very endearing. Matt's the only one who ever figured it out.
I guess because it was just something that everyone had talked about. It was foreshadowed. When was that? After she went through, I bet I know the face of the man I'm going to marry more than you, or whatever she was talking about. And then Eve thought she was talking about Lan, but she wasn't talking about, or Lan, sorry, but she wasn't. But a lot of people were shocked, because I've heard a lot of people say, like, where the hell did that come from? You know?
It came from the My Dearest Tom. Yeah.
Yes, I know.
I give it away.
I know.
Yeah.
But a lot of people weren't. I told my husband, because he has not read The Gathering Storm yet. He's like, no, I'm not reading any of them until they're all out. He's read up to Knights of Dreams, but he won't read the last ones after Robert Jordan passed until they're
finished. That would drive me crazy.
It drives me crazy because I can't talk about it, but I did tell him. I said he already knew that Maureen was going to be rescued, so I wasn't really spoiling anything, but I said this is the book where, you know, supposedly Maureen's going to get rescued and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, his first words were, so Tom's going to get lucky. So if he even knows, like, he's not very up on, you know, paint, like, he's not into theorizing too much and all that stuff. He just likes reading the books. And so if he figured it out, then I think anybody should be able to. But yeah, no, that's exactly what he said. I was like, oh, that's not what I was thinking about. Yeah, I'm definitely thinking of other reunions, not, I mean, it was cute, but it was just, it was definitely weird because we haven't really seen a lot of, on page, you know, romance with them.
Well, but, starting with the very first book, way back in The Two Rivers, cause I'm trying to, I'm already behind, but I'm trying to follow along with Brandon with his Wheel of Time read through, but of course he's already in the gallery with The Great Hunt, and I'm still in The Wheel of Time, and nobody's paying me to read the book.
Yeah.
I have to fit it in with everything else, so I'm afraid I'm gonna be hopelessly behind by the time he's done. But I am enjoying his tweets and posts on Facebook about what he's, you know, observing as he goes through.
Yeah.
But way back in the very first encounter, almost with Tom, Miranda asked a little bit about him, and as they leave the Two Rivers, one thing that was really out of character for her, but foreshadowed their relationship, was when they're on the ferry, I think, crossing the Tarrant River, and I think that the ferryman and the ferry owner are possibly planning to rob them because when Lon splashed all that gold around, and so Lon's got the boys standing around trying to look dangerous with their weapons and everything, and Tom pulls out a knife and rolls it across his fingers and splashes it around, makes it disappear, and then, you know, trimming his nails a bit and stuff like that, and Moraine laughs delightedly. I mean, that's really out of character for her in a lot of ways, and I think she's kind of taken with him almost from the very beginning. There are a lot of little things after that. And he outright thinks after she comes to him, after she comes to him in the Stone of Tears, he thinks a couple of times about her before she disappears. And one time I remember particularly, I think it was after she visited him in the Stone, but I could be wrong. He thinks, you know, now there is a woman with every grace a man could wish for. Too bad she dies to die, sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the first part of it says, you know, there is a woman with every grace a man could wish for. But then, and then I don't remember the exact words after that. But yeah, too bad she's tied up in the White Tower.
Right.
Powerful eyes to die. What a bummer.
Personal friend of the Ammerlin, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He was already thinking of her in that way a little bit.
No, it's definitely there. It's just,
course,
I guess this is not, you know, obvious.
Yeah.
If you're not looking for it, maybe.
It's not quite as blatant as the Tuon and Matt relationship, or Fael when she first started following Moraine and Perrin around. And,
oh, God.
Yeah. No, man, that was
Or any of these others. It is a much more low-key relationship than, well, even the one between Lon and Nynaeve was for the first couple of books.
Yeah.
Call me thick-headed, but I didn't really catch on to that one until, you know, he shows up in the room where she's interrogating the Aes Sedai and kisses her thoroughly.
Really?
Yeah.
But in the first book. Like, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
In the first book, it was...
Well, you had to keep in mind that I was, like, a sophomore in high school at the time that I read the first books the first time, so...
And I was not.
Yeah.
Well, they were making allies of each other almost from the beginning. He was actually seeing her differently.
Oh, yeah. The end of Eye of the World. The end of Eye of the World really kind of gave it away.
No, even when
it was all three of them. When it was Nynaeve, after they all separated, and it was only Nynaeve, Lon, and Moraine, yeah. Remember when it was three of them?
Yeah, they were looking for him, yeah.
Yeah,
seeing her differently then.
Yeah, and you could tell from her thoughts as well, like, at least I thought. Now, I can't remember what it was, because I actually started rereading The Eye of the World, but they're still in the Two Rivers. It's just after Winter Night, so I haven't got there yet. But I do remember that around that time, I started getting an idea, okay, that's weird. Because I was thinking...
Maybe it's a girl thing.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
That romance somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And when she sneaks up on Lon and is like, ha ha.
Yeah, she's all bummed because he found her horse and she was expecting he wouldn't. I mean, in the beginning, they're in sort of a little contest with the professor, you know.
Right. Yeah.
But then she starts kind of making cow eyes at him and he's sort of, you know, mooning over her in his, you know, imperturbable way.
yeah, mooning over her in his kind of brooding fashion. It's a weird dichotomy.
Well, how do you think Moraine is going to... Did we really, really discuss that, or did I miss it? How do you really think she's going to react to all the changes? Not just Swan, but everything.
Well, I think it's Moraine, and she's just going to kind of take everything in, and... Okay, now, so, you know, what's the plan? I don't see her... I can't wait to see reunions and stuff is what I'm mostly... But I don't think of all the news that she's going to hear. I don't see her, like... blowing up or being like, I can't believe you did that, or, oh wow, this is how, like, I just kind of see her just taking it all in calmly, thinking about it, you know, and then seeing where they can go from there.
And we'll we'll find out that the Finn actually had CNN in there, and she's really up to date on everything, probably more than most of them.
Right. Yeah.
I think Moraine, she might take a little bit of personal time with Su-on, you know, just because they are old friends. But for the most part, I think she's going to be incredibly focused on Rand and getting information that she has that he needs, and getting him to do the things that he needs to do at the last battle and during the last battle.
Right.
To save the universe and what have you.
I can't wait to see her and Rand. When Rand sees Moraine back, it's going to be... Cause she's always like, you know, she's on his list, and it's always in the back of his mind how he always says, you know, it's the one vision that Min had that didn't go through. Well, obviously, we knew that that wasn't going to happen, but he seems to think, you know, that she was really gone. And so we get to see what it is, too, about Min's vision, why he needs, you know, Moraine. Like, we're going to see what happened.
Yeah. I mean,
what
I think
information
he would almost... Yeah, I think
he would fail. I thought, or
almost certainly fail without a woman who's now dead and gone or something.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I do have to wonder what that's going to do to the psyche of Min, because, you know, she accepts that her visions come to pass, that her visions are true, but I think she might be clinging to kind of this false hope that because she has this one vision that obviously can't happen because Moraine's
right.
dead. That maybe, you know, some of these other visions she has of where Rand has to die and all this, that maybe they're wrong too. And so seeing that she's not wrong, that her visions are set,
yeah.
I wonder how much time she's going to need after that to kind of get over it.
Yeah, she's going to need some grief counseling or something like that. It's like good news, bad news, and then the good news is, yeah, you're not wrong, you're always right. The bad news is she really didn't want to be.
Yeah. I think she still knows deep down, though, that her visions always come true, and that maybe the one with Moraine is some kind of freaky, you know, weird thing, if she, you know, or something. She doesn't know for sure what's going to happen, right? It doesn't mean that Rand's gone forever or any of that. Like, you know, she doesn't know what happens or how her visions come to be or how they come to pass. She just knows that they're going to happen. So,
well, and she also, I think, doesn't have the added security that even Elaine has. Elaine, and I think Avienda probably does too, the knowledge that he is tied as one of the heroes of the Horn to the Pattern. And so even if he does die, we can just go visit him in Teleronriad and we're all good.
Remember, we were talking earlier about how if you eat in Teleronriad, does that nourish you properly? You know, well, we speculated on this before. If you, as you so delicately said earlier, get lucky with somebody in Teleronriad and you conceive, does that carry over to the real world too? I would think it must. Because we've speculated that Avienda gets pregnant in Teleronriad, but she hasn't been with Rand, but now she is. So.
Well, it is going to be a long book ahead, so who knows? There might be a couple of nights where he spends some time with different ladies, different of his ladies and men. Because he's been spending a lot of time with her and not so much with the others recently.
He always spends time with men.
Yeah.
Like, late, like, in the forever.
Yeah, Lane's already pregnant, so there's not much she can be doing, but Avienda's definitely in need of some quality time with Rand.
Yeah.
Oh, how far along is she?
I think Elaine is like 6 months along. She's showing maybe 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, so I think we kind of have to assume that the last battle is probably going to be over and done with before her kids are born.
Kind of looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does. But going back to what we were talking about with Moraine, you know, being so focused and just kind of taking everything in, I'd have to say that's probably true. Because, I mean, didn't she basically accept Tom's proposal and almost the next words out of her mouth is, we need to contact Rand?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, I'll get married, by the way. Where's Rand?
Yeah. Yes, I love you. I'm going to marry you, but I got to go find this guy.
Yeah,
I got this Dragon Reborn thing going on here. Got to deal with it.
Yeah, think of that in kind of today's terms. Yes, honey, I love you. Yes, I love you. Yes, I love you. By the way, do you know where I can find this other dude?
Oh, I'm going to lose
yeah.
it again. I just know it.
Yeah, Tom knows, though. So it's not...
Yeah, he understands.
I mean,
he gets it.
It's the friggin' Dragon Reborn. There's
Yeah, he's cool with it. But it's sort of like Nynaeve, and she's sort of like, you know, okay, I passed my test, okay, I'm gone from the boss, see you later, I'll be back tomorrow, and, you know, I'll do my contemplation, I gotta make a script first, come on.
Yeah. Yep, okay, I passed your stupid test, which stupid test was stupid. And I'll do my night of contemplation and whatever before you do whatever the heck you're going to do. But first I gotta go run do something
right.
to y'all later. Did anyone else cheer when she finally got his bond?
Oh, yeah. I love the way she set Morella down, too.
I know.
Come back later.
That was
I'm
cool.
Occupied. I love that. Morella's going like, oh, come back tomorrow. I am occupied. Occupied with her shirtless feeling on her sitting on the 10th floor. Okay. Well, they did say she married all three of her warders, so.
Yeah.
There you
good.
Go. Quality time with the warders.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, I like how Vaughn knew it. Like, he knew when Nynaeve got his bond.
He was pretty sure.
But, like, he thought.
Positive.
I mean, he didn't know for sure, but then, you know, as time started going on, he could sense that it was her because it seemed more like her.
And so what happened when she was in the testing Tarangriel? She's got to have been one of the first women ever to go through the testing Tarangriel, already bonded to a war. Oh, no, they weren't bonded when she tested. Never mind. Forget I spoke. But Elaine will be.
Yeah.
If she ever goes through the testing Tarangriel, she's courted to Brigida. Does that mean that the warder is going to experience all that pain and suffering too?
For the sake of Rand, I hope not.
Yeah.
And did Morel?
We do know that there's absolutely zero chance that Elaine will go anywhere near that thing while she is pregnant.
Right.
Oh, and so if we assume that Rand is going to die during the last battle, and I think this is my own personal little thing, but I think it might be safe to assume that Brigida's going to die during the last battle. We may never know what will happen to a warder if their Aes Sedai or their bond mate goes through the testing Tarangriel.
Hmm. Oh, I don't even want to think about people dying.
I know. Well, there's nothing.
People have to die.
I know that.
They must.
And I
they
actually
must
want
die.
People to die because it makes for a better story, but I don't want to think about it.
Yeah. But anyway, dragging us back to the topic, we definitely want to thank Charlie for that voicemail. And as always, we appreciate everybody's comments and input. I think that's the last voicemail. Maybe anybody else have any comments on any of the voicemails that we've listened to?
No, I just want to thank David, John, and Charlie, all three of you, for your voicemails, and everyone else who has sent in voicemails over the course of however long that the voicemail option has been available. And
I love
for providing several minutes of wonderful discussion.
We'll be open.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks again. So I think that'll pretty much wrap up our voicemail podcast. Once again, we want to thank everybody who took the time to call in and all the people that send emails. Eventually, we'll get those on the show as well. So thank everybody for listening. We hope you enjoy listening to us talk about the Wheel of Time as much as we do and as much as we enjoy reading it. So, until next time, this is Virginia saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun tonight. Thank you, everybody, who sent in a voicemail. Take care.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.